From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Jeffrey Wolfe on fiction, truth, and growing up with a father who's a con man. Also today, we meet saxophonist Maceo Parker. For years, he backed up the godfather of soul, James Brown. Now Parker has a new jazz record. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two albums that he describes as so awful they fill you with awe. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has confirmed the nomination of David Souter to the Supreme Court. Nine senators voted against the nomination, citing concerns about his commitment to civil rights and his refusal to state a position on abortion. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Today's debate echoed the earlier debate at the Senate Judiciary Committee, which voted to confirm the New Hampshire-born jurist 13-1. The 90-9 vote was the final test for David Souter, who will be sworn in later this week as the 105th justice on the nation's highest court. Senators largely sang Souter's praises, pointing to his intelligence, integrity, compassion, and his ability to listen. But those voting against his nomination, while agreeing that he possesses these qualities, said they were concerned about what was left unsaid, questions that were left unanswered, namely his refusal to state a position on the right to privacy, specifically a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. Washington Democrat Brock Adams said 2,000 people on death row know Souter's position on the death penalty, yet hundreds of thousands of women have no idea where he stands on the right to privacy. Judiciary Chairman Joseph Biden said Souter was not the man he would appoint to the bench, but he was convinced that Souter would not run roughshod over established constitutional principles. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
As of this hour, there are no longer an East and West Germany. There's only Germany, united for the first time in 45 years. The two countries became one at midnight, Berlin time, marked by the tolling of a bell that's cast in the image of America's Liberty Bell. In an interview on French television, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has claimed that Iraq and Israel are conducting secret negotiations. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
In a live interview from Cairo, Hosni Mubarak said it was widely known that Israel and Iraq are holding covert talks. He didn't give any more details, but he did suggest that the Palestinians were at the center of the discussions. Mubarak said Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has made no effort to resolve the Palestinian problem. He said Hussein's arguments, in reference to Kuwait, will give Israel justification to maintain its own position in the region. The Egyptian president said he didn't think Israel would attack Iraq without a clear reason. He also went on to say he supports French President François Mitterrand's proposal for establishing peace in the Gulf. The plan, which Mitterrand proposed last week at the United Nations, involves the release of all hostages and an Iraqi promise to leave Kuwait. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The United States has agreed to grant Israel $400 million in loan guarantees to build housing for Soviet Jewish immigrants. Diplomatic sources stress that the money comes with the condition that it not be used in the occupied territories. On Wall Street today, prices ground to a mixed close. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 11 points to close at 2,505.2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of the most fascinating memoirs to read side by side are The Duke of Deception by Jeffrey Wolfe and This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolfe. The two writers are brothers, but they grew up separately because when they were children, their parents divorced. Tobias lived with his mother, who was broke and ended up getting involved with an abusive man. Jeffrey lived with his father, a Yale-educated man of refinement who schooled his son in how to be a gentleman. But as Jeffrey later learned, his father really was a con man who had made up his credentials and his lineage. Jeffrey Wolfe, the older brother, is my guest today. He's the author of several novels. His new one, The Final Club, is loosely based on his own experiences as a student at Princeton University in the late 1950s. He describes the elitism and snobbery the students displayed toward each other. The example that was particularly devastating for Wolfe and his main character was Bicker. Bicker was the process by which the 20 eating clubs at Princeton chose new members. As an upperclassman, if you didn't belong to an eating club, you had no place to eat on campus.
At a time in the middle of the year, they suspended classes in order to have us interviewed, all of us, all sophomores, interviewed by upperclassmen in our rooms for 5 to 7 hours a day for 12 days. People would come and judge our livery, our haberdashery, our bona fides, our bloodlines, our agreeableness as potential eating mates, and they would gradually do a great winnowing, and they would find favor with some and find disfavor with others. Now, the way the system worked, almost everyone was asked to join an eating club. But at the end, there were between a dozen or perhaps 25 people who were pariahs, who were invited to dine in the town's restaurants rather than the eating clubs. And before I had a chance to be pushed, you might say, I jumped. So halfway through Bicker, I found this system so intolerable that I left the university for a year.
When you look back on the Bicker experience now, does it still seem as profoundly disturbing, or does it seem really less important?
It seems extraordinary to me. And the part that seems extraordinary to me is not that children, because that's what we were, it isn't that children are capable of that kind of cruelty to one another and that kind of stupidity to one another, but that the institution validated it, the institution allowed it, the institution suspended classes in order to make it happen. I mean, all of this has changed now. Now there is such a thing as Bicker, but only a handful of people play that game, and so it's all right. I don't care if a handful play it. It's when the whole mess of us had to that is so extraordinary. I find it profoundly disturbing that an institution that I loved, and I say that with a certain understanding that it's hard to love institutions today in the year 1990. Not many people love institutions, but in the year 1956 and in the year 57 and 58, we loved that institution. A lot of us did, and that the institution that we loved somehow betrayed us with this horrible system it had invented.
I'd like to give our listeners a sense of what it was like for you growing up, and I'm not quite sure how to do it except for to ask you briefly to tell a really complicated story, which is maybe to just sum up some of the disguises your father used over the years and who he really was.
My father represented himself as a very well-educated man, and I mean, so well-educated that he represented himself as having a degree in aeronautical engineering from the Sorbonne, which is, of course, a school of the humanities, has no aeronautical engineering degree anyway. His ambition in the beginning, I believe, was to impress his father, who was a surgeon and very hard to impress. And then he tried to impress others, and the process of trying to impress others was always self-aggrandizement. He claimed to have been a war hero, for example, in ways that were awfully hard to reconcile, because he claimed to have parachuted in among the Yugoslav partisans at about the same time he was flying with the Flying Tigers over Burma. His process always was engorgement. I mean, he had huge appetites, and he was a person who said, just a little bit too much is just enough for me, for example. He was, I suppose, what you'd call clinically a psychopath, in the sense that he seemed to have no moral conscience. He'd write bad checks in a restaurant, but he always tipped in cash. He knew how to take care of the help. He was immensely charming. He was witty. He was well-read. He was very quick. He was very smart. He was very warm. he was a crook, and he spent the last years of his life in prison.
But when you were growing up, you didn't know any of this.
No. When I was growing up, he was a hero, and I idolized him, and I idolized him probably for the right reasons. I idolized him because of his warmth and his wit and his unfailing attention to me. He was a very loving man. He had many friends. And so the particulars of his curriculum vitae were all unknown to me and at that time of no interest to me. So in an odd way, I could say that I had a happy childhood except when he was away, which was a lot of the time.
How did the masks get taken off?
Well, a lot of them get taken off when a son or a friend begins to become acute enough to see that things aren't matching up, that they don't make any sense. He got caught. Well, he rose to the august position of assistant chief engineer at Boeing at the time they were building the XB-52. And because he had to have atomic clearance for that, it was after the war, it was, I think, 1949, 1950, he got caught by the FBI. And the FBI traced back all his job resumes. And job resumes were okay. They tracked back. He'd worked for North America and he'd worked for Northrop. But all of a sudden, they tracked him back to the Sorbonne, that all of that monkey shines with the Sorbonne and the and Yale and Groton, and he hadn't even been born where he said he was born. He liked the idea of having been born in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So at about the year 1937, which was a rather potent year, he fell off the face of the earth to the FBI, and I'm here to tell you they were very upset by that.
So did you learn about this through the FBI?
I learned some of it when the FBI came to visit our house in Seattle. And I remember how nice they were. I mean, how kind and gentle they were, the FBI agents. In fact, they told me that they'd like me to leave the room, and they were extremely polite, courteous to my father. And when they left, for the first time I saw him deeply shaken. But at the same time, you know, by then, the circumstances of our life had been so erratic. We'd lived high life and low. We'd lived in horrible rooming houses and in antebellum mansions. We had lived off the cuff. We had lived in the Ritz-Carlton, and we'd lived in a cold water walk up in Niagara Falls. We'd lived all over the place. So by the time this happened and I was 14 years old, I didn't know what to expect anymore, ever. And that seemed all natural to me because we take the extraordinary in our lives almost for granted in an odd way. I think all children do that.
Did you ever talk to your father and confront him with the truth of his identity?
I did it twice in particular. The first time, I will never forget, I'd grown up with the last name that I have, Wolf, and as it happens, my father's father was a Jew, and my father's mother was a Jew. As it happens, my father's father was a Jewish atheist. My father represented himself as an Episcopalian and absolutely denied his Jewishness, so he absolutely denied mine as well. And at a time when I was at the Choate School, I'd spent some time looking in the mirror. And I said, boy, that certainly looks like a Jewish boy to me that I'm looking in the mirror at. And I remember asking my father for about the third time, I said, am I Jewish? And I remember him becoming extremely exasperated in a very calculated and in a very effective manner. And he said, for God's sake, he said, you know me. Am I an anti-Semite? And I said, no, you're not an anti-Semite. And he said, then why in the world would I lie about being a Jew? Why in the world would I lie about such a thing? And at that moment, my choices were binary. I either had to disbelieve him about everything, that I knew, or I had to believe him. And it was a horrible and unforgivable thing that he did to me that day. And, of course, I won't forget it. The other time I confronted him is by writing a novel called Bad Debts, in which I wrote what turned out to be a cartoon version of him, a kind of a caricature version of a con man. And I sent him that book shortly before he died. At the same time, he was stone broke. He'd just gotten out of prison. He had some Social Security. And he was getting checks from me every month. And after he read that book, Bad Debts, he stopped cashing the checks, which is the most extraordinary thing of all the extraordinary things I know about him.
So, have you gone through an incredible identity crisis, so to speak, or do you just accept you are who you are?
I'm a writer, so all of life is an identity investigation, but it's not a crisis in the sense that, I can't judge myself. I can't judge what psychological damage all this has done to me, if any. I can say it's been great material for me as a writer.
That's really true. And part of that material is in your memoir, The Duke of Deception, which is a book about your father. My guest is Jeffrey Wolfe, and he's the author of a new novel called The Final Club, which is set at Princeton University. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Jeffrey Wolfe is my guest. Well, we've been talking about lies that your father told when you were growing up. Did you ever do a lot of lying yourself when you were young?
Oh, when I was a kid, I sure did. For one thing, I used to lie about him. I remember when we lived in Sarasota, Florida, and I lived there with my mother, and my father was, in fact, in Turkey as an engineer. And I used to tell people down on the pier, all these old geezers, these retired people down on the pier in Sarasota, I'd tell them that he was a trapper in the Maine woods, that my dad was a trapper in the Maine woods, and that he had an Irish setter that he lived in a cabin with, and that I was soon going to join him up there. I was a storyteller back then, and I'm a storyteller now, but now I get paid for it.
you credit Richard Blackmore, the poet, who was one of your teachers at Princeton, with showing you that you could tell the truth in your own language and make that a really interesting form of fiction, that you didn't have to fabricate a different self for your voice as an author.
Well, that's the other side of Princeton, and it's a side of Princeton that I don't want to neglect for a moment, and it's a side of Princeton that is prominent in The Final Club, and that is the great inspirational moments that a lot of teachers gave us there, an encouragement to find our own voices. The first time we were treated as though we were adults.
I want to get back to the idea of writing in your voice as opposed to in a false voice. I'm reminded of a letter that you wrote when you were in college that you reprint in The Duke of Deception, your memoir about your father and growing up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a letter that you wrote after trying to feel up and make it with a girl who you were out with. And so the letter reads like this. Had a great time with my mater in D.C., dined at the Mayflower. Plenty of nook up here in Maine. Went the distance last night with that babe from Walker's. Huge, Hooters, hot. Wheeled around in her old man's car, told him I had a license, scored in the back seat. Of course, not only isn't that the kind of language you were probably talking in at the time, maybe it was. It doesn't sound like the kind of language you use now. But a lot of that wasn't true, like scoring in the back seat. What's that an example of to you in...
Alas, it wasn't true at all.
Yeah.
Alas, I didn't score in the back seat. What that's an example of to me was was a trying on of voices. I mean, it brings, you've certainly made my ears go red. I'm blushing as I hear it. At the same time, I recognize in it an important truth about what writers do, is that in order to find the one voice that can belong to us, we try on a lot of voices that don't. And that is the process. It is, alas, a glacial process of discrimination. I found a voice that seems to belong to me when I wrote The Duke of Deception, which was my fifth book, and it took that long. The problem now sometimes is when I write fiction is getting rid of that voice that belongs to me and taking on the voices of my imagined characters. Sometimes my voice leaks in. Sometimes my voice leaks into places where it shouldn't leak in.
Writer Jeffrey Wolfe is my guest, and his new novel is set at Princeton. It's called The Final Club. Let's bring up the subject of your brother, Tobias Wolfe, who's also a writer now. And when your parents separated, he went with his mother, you went with your father. And as you were growing up, sometimes living the high life, sometimes living the low life, he was growing up in a near broke atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to come east, where you were living, to get away from his mother's abusive lover. He wanted to go to a boarding school and was hoping that you would help to get him in. And you did. I was wondering if you ever gave him advice on how to behave in a more middle-class kind of environment, the kind of environment he was about to enter.
Oh, poor baby, did I give him advice? Oh, did I give him advice? I gave him advice till it came out his ears. And that advice now, I mean, he and I spend a lot of time laughing at that advice. I taught him manners, but I also, I remember we had this extraordinary summer together in La Jolla, California. My father had a nervous breakdown. He was in a mental hospital, in fact, and my brother and I hadn't seen each other for, I think it was almost 12 years, and it was just before he went to the Hill School, and I just graduated from Princeton, and he didn't have a job. He was a little kid. He was 15. And so I was supporting us at the time. And I remember every day before I went off to work, I'd make him read a book, a whole book, and write an essay about it every day. I mean, I had this absolute power over him, and I exercised it. But he wrote for that summer every single day an essay, and every single day he read one of the great books that I assigned to him. And it was a horrible abuse of power on my part, but at the same time, I don't regret it now for a moment, and I'm not sure he does either.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people see you and your brother almost as this peculiar science experiment. What happens if two brothers are separated, live in completely different kinds of environments, in different social and economic classes, and then meet as young adults, you know? And now you both ended up as writers. You both ended up writing memoirs about growing up and about growing up with your parents or with your parent. it's really kind of remarkable. And I wonder how much you think is genetic.
Well, I don't know how much is genetic. He finds it less remarkable than I do. As a matter of fact, we had a conversation about this issue this morning. We talk almost, I suppose we talk three or four times a week. And we spend most of our time laughing. But we were talking about this very question: how remarkable is it that we both write? And he finds it utterly unremarkable. He said, "It's as unremarkable as saying two people have blonde hair, for example." I find it remarkable. So here we divide on it, because he can't imagine, as I can't imagine, doing anything other than what we do. He can't find anything remarkable in it, I think.
What surprised you most when you read your brother's memoir about growing up, this boy's life?
I'd always known he was smart. I didn't know that he was a genius. It's an extraordinary book. In an odd way, I found myself reading his book and forgetting he was my brother. He became a character apart from me. I mean, a character with absolute integrity. Part of it, of course, was extremely sad. Part of it was scarifying to me to see how unhappy he had been at times. But after I'd finished the book, I realized that what he had done in his book was a thing I'd tried to do in my book, too, was he had brought back alive and intact the whole complexity of what we call an unhappy childhood, that it isn't just monolithically unhappy, that it's complicated, very complicated, that there are parts of it that aren't unhappy at all. There are parts of it that are characterized by laughter and by singing and by friendships and by love and affection. And there isn't such a thing, or at least in my experience, and I think I can say in his, as a childhood that is simply unhappy.
Since you and your brother are pretty close now and you're both writers, are there ever territorial concerns over who owns a certain story that you share?
I think there have been in the past. That's ancient history, and it's also comic history. That's the kind of thing we wind up laughing about. There used to be a time, for example, when I'd call him and tell him a story, and I'd say, "You can't use this. This is mine." And sometimes he'd do the same thing. We don't do that anymore because we don't have to. Also, we don't tell stories like that anymore in print. In other words, the neat anecdote, the joke or something, doesn't find itself into print quite as frequently as it used to in the bad old days with us. But the subject of who owns what now is a subject of high comedy, or I should say low comedy for us.
Do you feel that you're very good now at telling who lies, at spotting someone who is a con themselves?
Sure. But I used to be obsessed with lying. I used to be obsessed with lying and the truth, and I don't care about it so much anymore. I have two sons, and when they were first growing up, I used to tell them horribly. You'd sort of enjoin them always to tell me the truth, son, never lie to me. Quite solemn about it. And of course they didn't. I mean, they lie the way all kids do about all kinds of things that they don't think I should know, and they're absolutely right, I shouldn't know them. And so I've got a good laissez-faire attitude toward the whole thing now. But can I spot a phony? I think yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about writing. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been writer Jeffrey Wolfe. His new novel is called The Final Club. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. James Brown is the hardest working man in show business, you can figure his backup band works pretty hard, too. Coming up, we meet a veteran of James Brown's band, saxophonist Maceo Parker. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a couple of guilty pleasures, two albums that he knows are horrible, but that he likes anyway. And book critic John Leonard reviews The General in His Labyrinth by Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's his fictional account of the final days of Simón Bolívar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. With the noise of fireworks, the pealing of church bells, and the shouts of a giant street party, East and West Germany have been unified after 45 years of division. At the stroke of midnight, a giant black, red, and gold German flag was raised in central Berlin as police watched the thousands on the scene and millions more watched on television. The ceremony marked the return of a unified Germany after World War II and its defeat, but as Deidre Berger reports from Berlin, there is concern about the future.
Optimism here today, I would say. People are happy, but maybe not thrilled about unity. Most of the people are worried that things could get out of hand, that East Germany has a lot of economic problems, and that today is the beginning of a very difficult period for Germany. But still on the streets, mostly young people are out celebrating, and there'll be parties going on all night in Berlin.
Deidre Berger reporting from Berlin. In Washington, by a vote of 90-9, the U.S. Senate has confirmed the nomination of Judge David Souter to the U.S. Supreme Court. The only senator to miss the vote was GOP Senator Pete Wilson, who is campaigning in California for governor. Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell waited till just before the vote to announce his support, saying that Judge Souter reflected a reasoned approach and a sound understanding of the U.S. Constitution. Swearing-in ceremonies for the 105th Justice in the U.S. Supreme Court are expected to take place later this week. The new language of diplomacy in the Gulf crisis was matched by military movements in the region today. A U.S. aircraft carrier moved into the Persian Gulf as Iraq bolstered its ground forces in occupied Kuwait. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
The USS Independence moved for the Strait of Hormuz today in a show of force in the region. In addition, the Navy and the Marines carried out amphibious landing exercises in a drill that includes 18 ships and 90 aircraft. The American military movement comes at a time when President George Bush has offered a new diplomatic opening at the United Nations for an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. According to U.S. military officials, Iraq has moved almost half of its million-man army into southern Iraq and occupied Kuwait, another 100,000 soldiers since last week. In another development, France used naval power for the first time to enforce the United Nations blockade. A French warship fired three warning shots to stop a North Korean freighter. The ship was searched and allowed to continue when no Iraqi goods were found. In Dahran, Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10.5 points to close at 2,505.20 on volume of some 188 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. What's it like playing saxophone for the Godfather of Soul? In a little while, we'll find out from Maceo Parker. Everybody knows about guilty pleasures, those things you know you shouldn't like, but do anyway, those delights that are just plain indefensible. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead wants to share two of his guilty pleasures with us. Brace yourself.
Some records are so awful, they just naturally fill you with awe. And a couple of recent releases exert such a perverse fascination for me, I feel like I have to tell you about them. One of them raises mildness to epic proportions. It's a compilation of 26 Lester Lannan classics on the Epic label. Lannan's a genius at giving bland tunes bland arrangements and still making them shocking by interpreting them in totally irrational ways. We'll be right back. few band leaders have the vision to play Michael Row the Boat Ashore as a Dixieland number with an electric guitar solo, or do Shortening Bread as a twist, or recast the theme from Bridge on the River Kwai as a straitjacketed merengue. Lester Lanin is truly amazing. He can take any kind of music, jazz, Latin, rock and roll, anything, and systematically drain it of all vitality. For over 50 years, Lanin has been the king of society band leaders. He said that he can smell a debutante a mile away, which he probably didn't mean quite the way it came out. Sometimes I think Lanin is a tool the rich use to keep everyone else from being jealous. I mean, how great can their lives be if they have to listen to this stuff? Then again, maybe he's a cunning traitor to his class, numbing the brains of the wealthy to give the rest of us a chance to take over. Either interpretation gives this music sociological significance, so it isn't a pure guilty pleasure. But just try to find redeeming social value in this.
Other boys have girlfriends who are perfect as can be. But when it comes to you, my dear, there's a few little things that are puzzling me.
With your beat-up nose and your 13 toes, nature handed you a dirty deal. And all of my friends wanna know, are you for real? When you speak of love, you're no turtle dove. You remind me of a well-trained seal. Are you for real?
When it comes to guilty pleasures, nobody's guiltier than Jerry Lewis. A new anthology of Lewis recordings from the 50s, part of Capitol Records' Collector's Series, treats his daffy singles like serious art. It's a handsome, nicely annotated package. The CD even includes incomplete takes of one tune, as if we were dealing with some musical genius like Charlie Parker. But the music defies respectability. As the beginning of that last number reminds us, Lewis can sing pretty well when he wants to. But in his post-adolescent prime, he used his voice as a migraine machine, like on this monument to bad taste.
Good, my eyes were fine and in my pocket money. Then I saw her standing there, she was a pretty sight. But when she turned to walk away, I really saw the light and I went, yep,
boom,
ain't she nice, yep,
boom,
said it twice. I've never seen a gal that looks so friendly and retreat, yep.
Now check out Jerry's scat singing here.
Boom, don't, boom, don't, wah, 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 oh, booty, booty, don't.
Nice, huh? We could discuss this music's roots in vaudeville, Spike Jones, and Borscht Belt comedy. Or we could talk about how it connects with the so-called vulgar modernism of 50s milestones, like Mad Magazine, Chuck Jones's Warner Brothers cartoons, and the anarchic movies of director Frank Tashlin, including his Jerry Lewis vehicles.
Oh boy, here it is Sunday morning and I'm out driving in my car. And it's so peaceful and quiet. The sun is shining, the boys is jiving. Uh-oh, there goes a pedestrian. Shucks, I missed him. I think I'll go around the block and try again. Gee whiz, I must be out in the country now. I'm not hitting so many people. I am out in the country. I just hit a cow. This is a cow?
Yeah, we could analyze this nonsense all day, but dissecting it won't legitimize it. To tolerate this stuff, you just have to love the crass, the obnoxious, and the lowbrow. Like me!
Okay, in spite of Kevin's confessions today, he remains jazz critic for Fresh Air.
As could be. The champion was great, a real heavyweight, but you took him 2 out of 3. Holy gee, oh, you're not as large as a floating barge, but your cargo settled in your keel. You always say yes when I ask, are you for real? That's impossible. I laugh. I shriek. Ah! I squeal. You cannot.
This is Fresh Air. The best-known saxophonist and the godfather of soul's horn section is my guest Maceo Parker. One of Parker's best-known solos is on Cold Sweat.
Maceo! Come on now, brother. What it was that now? Ah! Let him have it!
James Brown is in a work release program now. Ever since his arrest a couple of years ago, members of his band have been out on their own. Parker has been playing with Bootsy Collins and the JB All-Stars. He just released a new jazz album called Roots Revisited. Parker met James Brown in 1964 through Parker's brother Melvin, a drummer. Brown had heard Melvin play and invited him to join the band if he ever needed a job. A year later, Melvin and Maceo had left college and were looking for work, so Melvin took Maceo with him when he went to take Brown up on his offer.
But I had to let my brother take the lead because, you know, he had met James before. He said, Mr. Brown, I don't know if you remember me or not, but I'm not in school and I need a job and I want a job with you. Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm a man of my word. You can have a job. And then it was time for me to, you know, clear my throat. Yeah, this is my brother. he needs a job, too. And that's really the way it was.
You know, I've been reading James Brown's memoir, and he writes about the time when he hired you both, and he says, I really wanted Melvin, but I figured I had to hire Maceo, too, if I wanted to get his brother. Of course, Maceo turned out to be fantastic. Did you realize at the time that he was hiring you to get your brother?
Yeah. You see, he hadn't heard me play. And, you know, I guess he figured if I could play somewhat close to, you know, what he heard my brother do, then maybe I would be okay and would fit in, you know, fit in as well. But he said, he asked me, do you play baritone saxophone? And I said, yes, sir, you know, with all that, you know, hesitation. And then he said, do you own a baritone saxophone? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, tell you what, if you can get a baritone saxophone, then you also, you know, have a job.
So you didn't have a baritone?
Did not have a baritone, but I had played baritone once.
What were you playing, alto or tenor?
I was playing alto and tenor, but I think tenor may have been my major at the time.
Mm-hmm. What were the first things James Brown told you about what he wanted from the horn section, what he wanted from you as a musician?
As the first thing, you know, had to do with the fact that I played baritone. And then when he heard me play baritone, he just said, okay, it seems like you can come up with, you know, your own part. Because I would listen to what he would tell the other horn players to play. And then I start playing something without him telling me anything. I start playing something. And then, it sounded okay. It sounded great. But, you know, if you're going to go into how I actually, you know, start doing a solo thing, how that came about, the guy doing the solo had to take off for, like, I guess a couple weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. And it was a rumor as to, it's sort of like an uproar kind of a thing, is what we're going to do now? The guy who plays the solo can't work for 3 weeks. What are we going to do? Should we hire somebody? And I said, Mr. Brown, I can do that. I can play, you know, the sax solos. He said, well, okay, well, I'll give you a chance. You know, I can, you know, I give you a chance. And I was playing solo ever since.
Baby, 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 I'm on a...
What did James Brown tell you that he expected from you on stage in the way, you know, how you dressed, what kind of movements you did?
Well, I had been to a couple of shows. In fact, James Brown and his group was one of the people who I admired, you know, at the time. And I could tell that he was a little bit strict on dress and mood of character and all this kind of thing. And if you can notice and kind of jot down things about a group when you visit a group, you kind of sort of know and learn what they expect without the person actually telling you that. But once I got hired or we got hired, you know you got to be on time. You got to have your uniforms and stuff got to be intact. You got to have the bow tie. You can't come up without the bow tie. You can't come up without the cummerbund. Your shoes got to be. Your patent leather shoes we wearing at the time. Got to be greased. You know, you just got to have this stuff. This is what I expect, and that was okay.
Did you get to if you left the band, did you get to keep the costume?
No. He bought the costumes. He bought the shoes, and for some reason, if you decide to leave the group, please leave. Please leave my uniforms with somebody.
When James Brown started playing funk, he started putting the accent on the first beat. When did he start telling you about the one in his music and putting the emphasis on the one?
He always liked to have a heavy one. That's what he felt. That was his style. Gonna have a funky good time. That's where the one is, like right there.
Was it hard for you to pick up on that, or did it seem natural?
It was hard when I had to solo. In that, I'm used to hearing the accent being on two. Like, if I would have done it, it would be gonna have a funky good time. Two and three and four. That's not normally how everybody was recording, and you could hear easily. I think their ear is easy to hear two and four, and that's where you clap. That's where the backbeat is normally.
Right.
You know, ting ta da, ting ta da, like that, two and four. But this was one. It was, and at first, like I said, at first it was a little awkward. But we became used to it.
Hit it. Oh, how you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Ain't so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, Jeff! Yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him! Ha. We're gonna have a funk good time. 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 Let's take him up, Fred. We gotta take you high.
Is it hard work working for the hardest working man in show business?
It was hard, but it was rewarding and it was fun because, you know, you're working with somebody who has this title, hardest working man. So that means you got to do your part. You got to keep up. And, you never want him to say, hey, man, you know, if I can do 10, 15 splits a night, you know, at least you guys can do play the little vamp or whatever it is, you know, for 45 minutes.
Were you on good terms with James Brown when he went off to prison?
Yes.
So what have you been doing since then? I know now you have a new jazz album, and you've been leading a group, but it's been about, 3 years?
No, it hasn't been quite 3 years.
Hasn't been quite 3 years?
No, it's been, I think right around January would be 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I've been doing a lot of things. The most important one I would think would be the Roots Revisited album that I did with produced with a guy from Germany.
This is your new album that you're talking about.
Yes, but there's been other things. I've done videos. I've done studio stuff. I've done some like smaller things and all of that.
Your new album is a jazz album. Why did you decide to do an album of jazz?
I hadn't done it before. It's something new. It's like why not? I mean, I can always do James Brown sounding stuff, you know. But what interested me was, and it was quite challenging as well as I knew it was going to be fun. And like I said, I hadn't done it before, you know, and the opportunity came to do it, and I said, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
When James Brown gets out, do you think that you'll get back together with him?
Yes. I'm sure that we're going to do some things. I want to limit it to, like, the real important things, like if they decide to do a movie, if they decide to do some specials, this kind of thing. I may not be able to do 100% of everything he does. In fact, I'm situated now where I can't do 100%. I'll try to do as much as I can because I know the people are still, you know, into, you know, James Brown saying and singing Maceo Blow Your Horn and, you know, doing this thing and I'm playing, you know. But I'm going to do as much as I can.
Well, you have other commitments?
Other commitments.
So are you telling us in a way that with James Brown in prison, you've become more independent?
Exactly.
Well, we're out of time. Maceo Parker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Maceo Parker's new jazz record is Roots Revisited. Here's Parker closing out a track on the album I'm Real that James Brown recorded with the rap group Full Force.
What do you mean you going? Where you going? You going too soon? Where you going? Good idea. Let's turn off the music. If we turn off the music, then he'll come along with us, right? Let's turn it off. Bite it. The guy's still playing.
He's still monkeying.
Brother
down.
Can't hear. Yo, I know what, man. Let's leave and let's close the door. Let's lock him inside. Then he'll leave.
You better know.
Come on, let's go. Close the door. Brother's still playing.
Hey,
yo, man, I don't care. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Let's leave. Let's leave. Yo, Jerry, turn off the light. Click.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The unification of East and West Germany is now about to be accomplished. We'll have a report from Berlin on the ceremonies and the proceedings there, a discussion of the Soviet Economic Recovery Program, the 500-day plan, as proposed by Stanislav Shatalin, a Soviet economist, is visiting Washington, and talk with Robert Siegel. Also, President Bush will speak to the nation tonight, hoping to build some enthusiasm for the Federal Deficit Reduction Program. And the blues music of Robert Johnson, all the music, 29 songs in all, released on a brand new compact disc.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel Garcia Marquez has a new novel, The General in His Labyrinth, about the life of Simón Bolívar. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Simón Bolívar, who was also a wonderful writer, once wrote, "The South Americans have blundered through the centuries, as the blind blunder among colors." Garcia Marquez, of course, manufactures colors like a Picasso. That he should have novelized the father of his hemisphere was inevitable. The surprise is that he's novelized the end of Bolivar, the last wasting days and insomniac nights on the River Magdalena, when Bolivar himself was almost blind and had to be read aloud to, omitting entirely the beginning and the middle, when the colors burned the brightest. About Bolivar, you must understand that he was a perfect child of his revolutionary age, of Rousseau in the 18th century and Napoleon in the 19th, his personal heroes. He grew up in Europe, on Goethe and Beethoven, as if in a romantic novel by Chateaubriand. He took equally to war and to women, kicked the Spanish out of the Americas, personally invented six new nations, and freed their slaves. Carlyle compared him to Ulysses, and Byron even borrowed his name for the yacht he sailed off in to try to save Shelley from drowning. But we don't meet Bolivar in these pages until he's 47, bitter and shriveled and dying, probably from tuberculosis, maybe from guilt. He is Oedipus at Colonus, or Lear at Dover. On his barge, he howls. Readers who need their magic realism will get plenty of it. Earthquakes, volcanoes, monkeys and snakes, fire beetles, Bedouins and ghosts, rockets and bagpipes, hammocks and harps, alligators with their jaws open to catch butterflies, and bears that thread needles, and mules that eat bedrooms. But Bolivar, not the least bit superstitious, lived and died in history, usually of his own making. And Garcia Marquez would have us believe that on this river journey to his death, history is what consumes him, like a fever. Memory purges. As the doctors administer enemas, so does the novelist. The The novelist is sympathetic, especially to the liberator's dream of a united Latin America. And in a confrontation with his European critics, Bolivar is allowed the last word. Don't try to have us do well in 20 years what you have done so badly in 2000. Damn it, please let us have our Middle Ages. But the novelist also knows, as many North American reviewers of The General and His Labyrinth don't seem to, that Bolivar was part monarchist, that every constitution he ever wrote was rigged to protect the Creole aristocracy from the working class, the peasants, and most of all, the Indians. As in his Autumn of the Patriarch, Garcia Marquez speaks here for the mute and colorblind masses, a kind of historical unconscious, whose affliction, before and after Bolivar, has been oligarchs. As the mirror clouds, and the clock stops, and the radiant voices of the slaves from his childhood sugar mill sing at a dying star, Bolivar's nightmare in this novel is of Piar, the mulatto general, his comrade in arms, whom he murdered. General Bolivar might escape the labyrinth, but Latin America hasn't. How perverse of the Nobel Prize winner. We wanted more Macondo magic, or maybe another installment of the riverboat lovebirds in their frisky dotage. What does he do but give us death and politics?
John Leonard is a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The General in His Labyrinth by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Keith Carradine talks about life in a family of actors. And Finnish filmmaker Aki Kaurismäki tells us about his new film. It's about a Siberian rock and roll band that's so bad, they're told to come to America where people will swallow anything. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.